checklists. No moving parts, practically. But it's got a lot of pieces to it. A lot that can go wrong. The last item on the checklist was the receiving antenna station. One hand pressing the earphone to the side of her head, Van Buren called White Sands. "Rectenna Farm ready and waiting," she announced. Dan wet his lips, then said, "Okay. Let's do it." The head engineer gestured to the master console. No one was sitting at it. "I thought you'd like to press the button yourself, Chief," she said. Dan hesitated, then shook his head. "No, Lynn, that's your job. I won't deprive you of it." Her brows hiked up. "You're certain?" "The pleasure is all yours," Dan said, surprised at the superstitious dread that kept his hands jammed in his trousers pockets. Van Buren wasn't superstitious. "Okay, then?" She raised her voice so that everyone in the crowded, tense room could hear her. "On my mark! 5 seconds and counting! Mark!" Dan knew that the team at White Sands heard her, too. 3, 2, 1. Van Buren leaned ostentatiously on the red button that activated the satellite. Section 1 is go," sang out one of the techs. Section 2, full output. Section 3, okay." One by one, the 50 component solar panels began converting sunlight into electricity. "Inverters powering up. Magnetron 1 on. Magnetron 2. The magnetrons converted the electricity into microwave energy. Antenna powering up. The antenna was a compartmented metal box nearly a mile long that focused the microwave power and beamed it toward Earth. Suddenly Dan realized he didn't remember if the checklist included making certain that the antenna was pointed correctly at the Rectenna farm. "It has to be," he told himself. "They use a laser beam as a guide. If it strays out of the Rectenna field, the magnetrons turn off automatically." Yet he couldn't recall if he'd heard anyone check out the beam's aim. Van Buren gave a sudden whoop. "White Sands is receiving power!" Dan raced her to the console that displayed the data White Sands was transmitting. Leaning over the seated technician's back, they saw the power curve ramp up almost exactly along the predicted curve. 500 megawatts. 1,000. Dan's insides were churning. He could feel his heart thumping so hard it was threatening to break through his ribs. 2 gigawatts. 4. 6. 10 gigawatts! Van Buren hollered at the top of her lungs. Everyone roared. Dan grabbed his chief engineer and danced in the aisle between the consoles with her. Technicians threw their headsets in the air. "Break out the champagne!" somebody yelled. Dan waved his arms and shouted as loudly as he could, "No celebrating until she's run for 30 minutes. Then we'll shut her down and head for Hangar A. That's where the champagne's stashed." More quietly, he said to Van Buren, "And I want the bird on the pad, ready to go."
"You won't need it," she said confidently.
"I hope you're right," said Dan. "But get her set on the launch pad anyway." Then he noticed that Al-Bashir had his cell phone pressed against his ear, jabbering away over the noise of the impromptu celebration. Baikonur, Kazakhstan. It was just after 3 a.m. when the van carrying Nikolaev, Williamson, and Buchachi stopped at the base of the gantry tower. The three men clambered down stiffly from the van onto the steel flooring, each of them encased in a cumbersome, dull orange spacesuit, the visors of their fishbowl helmets open. A dozen technicians in quilted coats and leather hats with ear flaps bustled around them. The big proton rocket loomed above them all, illuminated glaringly by huge spotlights, icy white vapor wafting from its upper stage.
"The world's most reliable rocket," Nikolaev said cheerfully. "Safer than driving automobile."
Williamson scowled at the Russian and his fake joviality.
"Let's get on with it, then," he said,
heading for the open cage of the elevator. Buchachi, shivering from the cold even inside the thick spacesuit, clumped glumly after him. As the elevator creaked and groaned slowly upward, Nikolaev asked,
"You know of Red Hand's disease?"
Buchachi's eyes widened.
"What are you talking about?"
Nikolaev explained that in the old days of the Soviet Union, guest cosmonauts from communist nations were allowed to ride up to the Salyut space stations for short visits. When a Hungarian cosmonaut returned to the ground after a week in orbit, the medics were disturbed to find that his hands had turned red. They feared some strange space malady and wondered what to do about it.
"Finally, one of the doctors asks Hungarian about his red hands," Nikolaev went on. "Hungarian says, 'Of course I have red hands. I am guest on the Russian space station. Every time I went to touch anything in space station, one of Russians slapped my hands.'"
Nikolaev laughed heartily, while Buchachi managed a polite smile and Williamson frowned.
"I understand," Buchachi said as the elevator stopped at the uppermost level. "We are guests aboard your spacecraft. We are not to touch anything."
"Or you get red hands," Nikolaev warned, still laughing.
There were six more technicians waiting for them at the top level. The wind was howling up there, cutting icily. The sky was dark and full of stars. Williamson turned a full circle on the steel platform, searching for one particular star that should be bright and steady low on the horizon. The power sat. He couldn't see it. Of course not, he realized. It's on the other side of the world. Two of the technicians touched his shoulders and nudged him toward the hatch of the Soyuz TMA spacecraft. Williamson had practiced this 100 times in the simulators, but somehow this time was different. He stubbed his booted foot on the lip of the hatch and would have toppled to his knees if the technicians hadn't been there to hold him up. They literally lifted him off his feet and shoved him through the hatch, boots first. Inside, the spacecraft was as cramped as a sardine tin. Grumbling inwardly about how stiff his spacesuit felt, Williamson clambered over two of the couches that had been shoehorned in among all the equipment and controls, then slid awkwardly into the farthermost couch, banging his helmeted head on a protruding electronics box as he leaned back. Nikolaev slipped in next to him, so close that their shoulders pressed against each other.
"It's easier once we reach orbit," the Russian said confidently. "In zero gravity, this coffin gets bigger. You'll see."
Buchachi clambered in hesitantly. He was still settling into his couch when the technicians closed the hatch and sealed it. "We're in for it now," Williamson thought. "No way out." Nikolaev adjusted the pin microphone inside his helmet and began chattering with the controllers in Russian. After several minutes, he said,
"Down visors."
He slid the visor of his helmet down and it sealed with a click. Williamson and Buchachi did the same.
"Now we wait,"
Nikolaev said, his voice muffled by the closed helmets. His cheerful demeanor was gone. He looked totally serious to Williamson.
"Got to piss,"
Williamson realized. There was a relief tube in the suit, but he wasn't certain he was connected to it properly. The dour technicians, mostly Asians, who had helped them get into the spacesuits, had paid little attention to the plumbing. Would it short out some electrical circuits if it leaks? Williamson wondered. He decided not to try it.
"I'll wait. I can hold it."
He heard thumps and grinding noises. Pumps starting up, he wondered. Or something gone wrong. The tight, hot little metal sarcophagus started vibrating like a tuning fork.
10 more minutes, Nikolaev said.
More bangs and groans. Metal expanding, Williamson told himself. Or contracting. He thought he heard the wind keening outside. A storm coming up?
5 minutes, said the Russian. Everything automatic from here on.
The big rocket was coming to life. Pumps gurgled. Pipes shuddered. The lights on the instrument board, 6 inches in front of their faces, blinked several times, then steadied. Most of them were green, Williamson saw. A display screen lit up with a complex of grid lines and colored curves. Nikolaev adjusted a dial below the display screen, but it didn't seem to have any effect on the image. Williamson and Buchachi had radios in their suits, earphones built into their helmets, but Nikolaev had not bothered to patch them into the circuit he was listening to. The cosmonaut said something in rapid, fluent Russian. Then he broke into a big grin and nodded inside his transparent bubble of a helmet.
"Da, da, da svidaniya."
Once they lifted off, Williamson